From the heart of the Forest City, focusing on the biggest stories in London, this is the Craig Needles Podcast. Now here's your host, Craig Needles.
It's the Craig Needles Podcast. It is time for the Friday Roundtable here from our comfy, cozy studio at the Covent Garden Market. And I am joined in the studio today by Scott Kitching, Blackburn Media News Manager, Shauna Lukowitz, former NDP candidate in London West, and former City Council candidate Jeremy McCall. Hello, everybody. Thank you for being here today.
Hello, Craig.
Great seeing you all.
Are we all comfortable?
Very comfortable in these cozy couches and chairs.
I feel like I should have like a cup of tea in my hand.
Yeah, next time, Craig.
I'll see you. Has-beens is like right on the other side of this wall. So perfect. Yeah, maybe we can do that. Let's get to the stories of the week and the big things that are going on. There's a lot of stuff, and I want to talk about health and homelessness. And just to get out of the way first, a lot of people ask me about what happened on the podcast on Tuesday. I had about an hour-long sit-down with Susan Stevenson. If you haven't listened to it, I recommend that you do. And a lot of health and homelessness conversation came from that. I don't necessarily want to talk about this in the lens of social media and sort of some of the stuff that's been going on there this week and what's going on with sex work and all that stuff. I talked about that a lot on Tuesday. However, the question that I asked in that podcast repeatedly, and never really got a firm answer on it, was what do you want to see happen here with health and homelessness? And I never got a great answer on that. And I'm just wondering, what do we think Londoners want on health and homelessness? I think everybody wants people to be healthy and happy and thriving and living good lives. But there's really no consensus on how we're getting there. And I think that the Hubs plan is perhaps moving slower than we'd want. We didn't get all of them approved. We wanted to do a dozen of these things. Right now we've got three. So what do you think Londoners want on the health and homelessness file? Where do people want to be? Because I just don't know what the answer is on that in the community. Or maybe there isn't an answer on it. Maybe everybody wants something different.
I think at the end of the day, I think you're right. Everybody just wants everyone to have a roof over their head and wants people to be healthy. We don't want to see, people overdosing in alleyways. And we don't want to see people in opiate-induced sleep on park benches for various different reasons. Some people don't want to see it because it offends their eyes. Some people don't want to see it because it breaks their hearts. I think ultimately what we all want the same thing. What's different is how we get there. And I think, for me personally, I have a great deal of sympathy for the people who find themselves in those situations, because the overwhelming majority of the time, it's the result of things that are 100% not their fault. We know there's a link between childhood trauma and addiction. We know this. And so when you see someone who is, in that opiate-induced sleep on a park bench, I would hope that people look at that with sympathy and with empathy rather than with contempt. Because I think that informs our response to it. So I think the easy answer to the question is just that. We all want the same thing. It's just, how do we get there?
Yeah, I agree with Scott. I think it's really important to acknowledge that, there are experts, and how we define experts, meaning people who, work in social services, people who have lived and living experiences of being unhoused and living on the streets, city staff, academics, a whole host of people who are part of this whole of community response, which is very innovative and potentially effective. And we haven't had an opportunity at all to see the results of that. And I think for any major social issue, it is always going to move much slower than what we would like. And what looks like success and what looks like progress isn't so immediate or identifiable for maybe even the general public. And there is evaluation and there is measurement that's going to come out of this that will be reported back to City Council and to us as Londoners. And I think we'll start to see what that means and what that looks like. But in the meantime, your conversation with Susan Stevenson really brought to light that, she hasn't given that answer in terms of what's the solution in her eyes. And honestly, I'm not sure she should be giving that answer, except that she keeps raising all these issues and questions, which I think is derailing the process and impacting the capacity of organizations and city staff to be able to respond to this issue. And to what end, you know? So she's raised the questions. You know, we can say, okay, whatever, that's great. But what are we doing with that? You know, she needs to provide that answer if she's going to keep, you know, kind of just going after this and going after this. You know, the bottom line is we want people to be housed, we want people to be healthy, and we want people to be well. She would agree with that. I think everybody would agree to that. We have a plan. Let's see it play out. Let's let it have its impact.
So I have kind of an interesting role. I work for Hutton House Employment Services, and my job has two components. Number one is we get a lot of referrals from places like Ontario Works for people that are kind of on the precipice of homelessness. And then I have to take those folks, kind of get them as job ready as possible. And then I have to approach the upper crust of London, for lack of a better term, and convince a local small business owner that somebody who might not do well applying through their Indeed algorithm is worthy of hire. And that person's coming to us because they're really running out of options or running out of time. And so the people who are, you know, on the fringe or already on the streets, they are just looking for options, they're looking for opportunities, they're looking for support, and they're looking for hope. Like, I get emails, the subject line, being evicted June 1st because the rent's going up, what can I do? And then I have to turn around and approach an employer and say, hey, this person, you know, they're in the situation due to circumstances out of their control. Nobody chooses to be diagnosed with schizophrenia. Nobody chooses to stay home for a couple of years with a sick parent during COVID. And now these algorithms we've made for employment negatively score those things and say, you have a work gap, therefore you are no longer employable, and the hole gets deeper and the well gets deeper and the hope goes down. And so the people I talk to on the business side, they're just looking for change. They're looking for progress. They're looking for the number of people on the streets and in the backyards and in the parking lots to be going down and not going up. I was at a meeting recently for the local hotel and restaurant management organization, and they represent most of Wellington Road South. And their big concern is, you know, putting people in that radio station is like the fourth hub in their neighborhood. They're saying, you know, we support these folks, we want to do our part, we're already doing our part, paying extra taxes, so on and so forth, but when do we start making it everybody's problem?
And here, I've actually got a little bit of time for that, and I know that people might think that's inconsistent because I kind of railed on the Northwest London people and the whole NIMBYism thing, which I stand by. But hey, this is the fourth hub in a relatively small amount of space, and the city's original plan was, let's have these all over the city. I've got some time for talking about that. I still think I would put a hub there if they have a chance, but I think that those issues are merited, and I'm willing to have a conversation about them. So, but you say, you know, let's make this, you know, everyone's problem, and really it is everyone's problem no matter what, because nobody wants to see this on the street. And as Scott said, you don't want to see it with your eyes, whether you don't want to feel it in your heart, whatever it is, the reason nobody wants to see this. And It frustrates me, and I know Shawnee said, you know, the stuff moves slow and social change moves slow, but it frustrates me that it is moving slow and it feels like it has been derailed. I do want to see people come forward with more ideas for hubs. We are different organizations in the community who have the capacity to do hubs. Let's see it. Let's continue to see that. I hope that's something that happens, but it just feels like we're kind of already behind here. And one thing I did that Susan said on the podcast on Tuesday that I agree with is we should be talking about winter response for 2024-2025 now. Mm-hmm. Because last year we heard, well, it's, you know, we're talking about in October. Well, it's too late to do this, too late to do that. I don't want to have that conversation again. Let's talk about it now. So I hope that's something that happens.
Yeah. And in the meantime, maybe we can allow the organizations and the staff and the folks who are working on this to focus on that instead of being distracted by these kind of like strawman arguments that keep coming up that, you know, don't really serve that purpose. Like, we're talking about so many organizations that are out there every single day doing really difficult work on shoestring budgets, mm-hmm. and then having to justify that, mm-hmm. and not every organization having to justify that, certain organizations having to justify that, you know, she may or may not agree with the ideology behind mm-hmm. what they do. Well, nobody's asking you that. That actually isn't your job, yeah. Councillor Stevenson. It's not. You know, these organizations are the the experts who are doing this work. And, you know, in terms of an effective response, it really does slow down the work when we're basically beating people down.
Yeah, and well, here's the thing. Something that Jesse Rogers said to me, who, of course, the executive director of ANOVA, and she's been on this roundtable many times, something Jesse said to me was that so much time for staff at those types of organizations is spent with, all right, we've got to do this paperwork to get this government grant,
yes,
and that piece of paperwork to get that government grant. So therefore, you know, the funding's inconsistent, which is a problem. And think about how much time could have been spent doing other things if you weren't filling out all this paperwork and jumping through all these hoops to make sure that the money's there. What if the money was just there? I know that that's easier said than done. I understand that. But that's part of what's going on with a lot of these organizations, too, is when the funding is sort of always precarious, that detracts from the efficiency of the organization.
Absolutely.
I think it's very true. So that's the result you wind up with. As for the debate between, you know, who's right and who's wrong about sex work, I want to talk about that in the podcast next week, and I hope that I can make that happen. We don't have to get into that today.
Well, that's because I'll just say.
Yes, please.
Because, you know, you can't say that and then have me not say
something.
You know, I think it's incredibly positive in terms of our community that actually the gender-based organizations are saying you don't actually have to choose.
Right.
And that there is a lot of cohesion in the community amongst them, mm-hmm, around providing different services and, you know, holding different viewpoints on that,
yeah,
being able to work together. It hasn't always been that way. That's huge progress for women and sex workers and anyone who is marginalized who may need these services. That's a step forward. So we don't actually have to choose.
Yeah. And I actually think it's bad if we do. I like the idea that there is a variety of services with a variety of opinions that are funded in various amounts by the City of London. So whomever it is that's determining which service can I go to, they can go to a spot that fits what they want. I think that's a good thing.
It is a good thing.
Yeah.
It is a good thing.
And I don't think that there needs to be perhaps a war between these organizations. I don't think that's productive either for the work they're doing at the base level. Because again, like we talk about the time it takes to fill out paperwork for funding. Well, if there's, you know, wars on social media about who's right and who's wrong about whatever laws on the books, that's taking up time too, and that's hurting the efficiency too. So if people, not everyone's going to be rowing in the exact same direction all the time, but if everyone's base idea is, hey, we want to do what's best for whomever it is that comes through that door next. That's what we should want.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And the city doesn't have to choose a stance.
No.
The city doesn't have
to
decide
so
that at all. You know, their pillar of a safe city for women and girls is being fulfilled by having these organizations being funded and offering up different options.
Yeah.
You know, there's no one issue that is solved by one answer. These are complex issues, right? Like housing and homelessness, the same way. You can't, you know, there's just not one necessarily pathway. And the idea that that's what leadership looks like she said in your podcast, is so misguided, because it's not. It's not sticking your feet in the sand necessarily. We can all have our opinions, and each organization has their own philosophy and beliefs and values that guide their work. That is the way it should be done.
Right.
But you know, overall, the city doesn't need to take a stance on that.
Yeah. And I think sex work is dangerous, and we'd be better off if there were fewer people that felt they had to do it. But at the same time, I'm also not naive enough to believe that there's a world where we're going to not have anyone doing sex work. That's not the reality we're ever going to live in. So, again, I want to talk about that more next week. But it's just as far as how the city has to navigate this, I don't think they really even have to.
No,
I think they can just, hey, you're helping people who are in London. Yeah, we can give you a few bucks. And the federal government funds, I don't know if the feds necessarily fund Safe Space, but the federal government funds ANOVA, and the federal government funds London Bees Women's Center, and the provincial government does the very same thing. Do they have to choose? No. So why does the city?
Yeah, and the whole point of client-centered care in social services is to meet people where they're at, right? And that involves them feeling comfortable with who they're going to for help, and accessing it in a manner that is accessible and that makes sense for them. So you need to have a variety of options in order to get people in the door and on their first step towards better, whatever their better might look like. And the problem is that, like we've kind of touched upon along the way, you can't have these warring factions forcing people to choose sides, making people feel unwelcome or judged or criticized or at risk for choosing to access a service. And we can't not be working together to move things forward. I don't know if it was Free Press or CBC. One of them asked every counselor about their thoughts on the social media stuff recently. The answer I liked the best was Jerry Pribbles. He said something along the lines of, "I don't read social media because it's all a nightmare." And I think that kind of sums up the whole point that we're not going to agree on certain things, and we're never going to agree by yelling at each other, calling each other names.
Sure. I think, though, from Jerry's perspective, you can't just put your head in the sand and think that this is everything's fine because I'm not paying attention to it.
Mm-hmm. Sure.
Like,
sure.
Yeah. But I get, I'm not going to read this.
Yeah. At the same time, if you went down Dundas Street to Oldies Village and asked every single person you passed, "Are you on Twitter?" you'd probably get three yeses.
Yeah.
Right?
Absolutely.
They have bigger things to worry about. I agree with that perspective.
So do I. And
to add some credence to the funding issue, I'll preface this by saying, I work in a federal government funded program. Love you, liberal government. You're the best. We're in year 15 of my program, which is funded in 3-year cycles. And right now I'm kind of a free agent at work because our contract ended April 30th and there's no new contract yet for the next 3 years. And, for 5 3-year cycles in a row, we've met all of our milestones, but you have to keep doing the same process over and over. And because they have some staffing issues, there's nobody to look at that application right now. So we're kind of in a floating position right now where I'm covering somebody else's opening until this stuff gets worked out. While at the same time, the people that I help are the people who are not being able to work to feed themselves, house themselves, and clothe themselves without the help that we provide. So there has to be some sort of better way to make these mechanisms work more smoothly and to focus on the work and not all the things you have to do to be able to do the work in the first place.
Let's move on now, because there are a couple other things I wanted to talk about this week. And everyone here has been or is a parent of kids who are in school. Now, everyone here has kids older than mine, but the cell phone conversation came up this week and the provincial government saying, "Hey, we're going to crack down on who's going to use cell phones when, distraction in the classroom." My first read on that was, hey, this is a red meat issue for voters of a certain age who are going to see this and say, "Yeah, I don't like cell phones either," and be mad about it. And yeah, get the kids out of there with them. However, at the same time, I'm willing to acknowledge there is some level of distraction, but cell phones are also calculators. Cell phones are also things where you can find relevant educational information on them. So I don't know if I like the idea of saying, hey, this is when you can and can't use a cell phone. I think it's something that can essentially be determined ad hoc, essentially. Who's the student using it? What are they using it for? What class are you in? Where do you stand on the government sort of doing the cell phone crackdown? Is it something that just really they're probably doing to appeal to a certain type of voter base? Or do you think there's some merit to this?
I think there's probably a little bit of merit to it. That being said, I had a similar reaction, I think, when this was announced. I mean, part of me was, and my metaphor here can be completely out in left field, but when it just sort of struck me as the house is burning, so we better ban pesticides for the front lawn. There are so many other issues that need to be dealt with in the Ontario education system that this one doesn't feel to me like it's in the top three. So, again, I would say to Minister Lecce, is this your top priority right now?
Yeah.
Is this how you're going to fix Ontario schools by getting cell phones out of classrooms? Or do you think maybe we should be looking at other things like staffing, like funding? So I don't dismiss it completely, but maybe it's the cynic in me, but it just sort of felt a little bit like, is the distraction that the cell phones are creating, or is this the distraction from the state of our education system right now, and seemingly a government that doesn't seem anyway to be super invested in or super interested in fixing it?
Here's why they went for this one. The red meat thing, like I said earlier. Also, this doesn't cost you money to do.
Mm-hmm.
The other things that might be a problem here are a little more, or in some cases, a lot more expensive to fix. Not that they aren't needed, but they do cost more money than just sort of saying, here are the rules now. That's basically free.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's kind of like, it feels like the strict parent reaction is like, I'm just going to take your phone away, and that's going to mean that, you know, I'm doing something. And that really fits the image, I think, of the Ford government and how they want to be perceived. But the fact that they didn't consult with teacher unions, they didn't consult with parents, you know, that school boards already had been, you know, told to, you know, have their own policies, which makes sense, because if school boards came up with their own policies, they'd be able to address the things that you talked about, Craig. You know, cell phones are a tool. They are an informational tool. Mm-hmm. And it doesn't do young people a service to not teach them how to use it in appropriate ways to find information and to better their lives and their knowledge. And it's kind of like where we're at with AI, right? Where it's just like, you don't use it. It's, you know, it's bad, it's this, instead of working with the reality that this is what is here, this is what is going to continue to be here. How do we help students and teachers and professors, you know, understand how to use it in appropriate ways that further their knowledge and their skills, as opposed to just outright banning it? So, you know, I think it's hard for anyone to really say, you know, at first glance, you know, it's hard to argue that there probably is overuse of cell phones in schools. But again, you don't have to like confiscate it and take it away and mm-hmm. kind of ban it in order to address those issues. Yeah. It's an easy soundbite. It's an easy sell, and maybe hard for people to really, you know, fight back against, but I don't think that it's all that effective, and it's not a good educational approach as far as I'm concerned.
What we've learned recently, well, not recently, but over the last few years from the school board, is that policies are about as valuable as the paper they're written on if they're not enforced, mm-hmm. right? And I think that the province, I think it mentioned back in 2019, it downloaded cell phone use to the school boards. Many of them did nothing about it. And I think that continuing to just ping pong the ball back and forth and make it sound like you care about certain issues without making progress on them doesn't really help anybody. My wife and I went to see Kevin Hart at Bud Gardens a couple months ago, walked in the door, got handed one of those Yonder pouches. They said, you lock up your device. If you're seen with it out before the show's over, you're removed. That was times like 13,000 people, right? And that was with the intent of his show not going online. But they had a specific plan to prevent an issue. They knew how they were going to handle it, and they handled it, right? And so I think when we keep bouncing around this greater idea of we should pay more attention, we should have less distractions, but don't take any specific concrete unified action towards it, nothing's really going to get better. I don't have high school kids, but I hear high school classrooms are a bit of a nightmare in terms of focus and noise going off and people not really focusing. But in my oldest grade 5 class, there's a bunch of kids with noise canceling headphones on. And apparently they told the teacher they needed them to help focus better. And my daughter said they're actually all listening to Spotify. Right? So kids will always find a way to get around things in order to achieve their best outcomes that they're looking for. And really, when we're putting 33, 35, 36 kids in a class, we're just amplifying issues. And I don't think cell phone use is the biggest issue in the school system right now. And it's unfortunate that that's the one that we're choosing to focus on.
Yeah. If we're talking about distractions in the classroom, 35 kid class is a way bigger distraction than the cell phone's ever going to be.
Mm-hmm. Well, here's the other thing too, is in high school, students are on their computers, like their social media, their messages, mm-hmm. all of that's connected to their computers. I don't know that you've solved any problem taking away their phone. They can still message through their computers. And then I had heard a student who had brought up the issue, and I hadn't considered it, but after they said it, I was like, whoa, yeah, wow. Like the issue of privacy and the amount of information mm-hmm. that is on our phones and how privacy can be violated if a phone is, you know, held by somebody else or taken. Like there's financial information, there's health information, there's obviously like communication that should remain confidential between like, you know, parents and children or whatnot. And, you know, I think that this could open up some other issues that haven't been considered.
Yeah, teachers shouldn't be taking unlocked phones. I don't think anyone should be on board with that. Something that somebody brought up to me, because I talked about this on the air on Classic Rock 98.1 this week, was, you know, there's a lot of bullying that goes on via cell phones. So, you know, social media, WhatsApp, Snapchat, whatever it is. I don't know what the age group is. Well, TikTok, certainly. And yeah, that's true. I just don't know if you don't get to have your phone during, you know, English class really changes that at all.
you know what it changes? It's going to change how the school responds to it. And the school is going to say, that's not my problem that your child is bullying my child, because that happened on social media and they're not allowed to have their phones on school property.
Yeah.
Right?
And this happened at home. This is a home problem.
This is a home problem. Yeah.
Yeah, that's fair.
Yeah.
And I don't think it is a home problem.
It is not a home problem. It is not.
Yeah. So yeah, that's the other thing. So I just don't know what problem we're solving here, other than, hey, this is a cheap, easy one where you can get some points and send out some tweets that some people are going to like, and that's it. So, like, you know, like Scott said, there's lots of problems in the education system right now. Go solve some of those.
Yeah.
But those are harder problems. So this is what you do instead. And I think that is...
And kids don't vote.
No,
because if they did, there wouldn't be this policy, right? Because you can imagine they're not very happy.
No, I think that's a good bet.
Well, it feels like something that unfortunately, and I mean, this is, you know, just kind of a anecdote, I suppose. But it feels to me like something that we've seen in our political culture in Canada over the last number of years is a move toward more of the appearance of doing something rather than actually doing something. You know, identifying a problem and tailoring your response to it based more on the appearance of doing something rather than actually trying to fix the problem. And I just, this feels like that to me. Because like you're right, there are serious issues in our education system. And I don't see where a kid having a cell phone in the back of grade 12 history class is anywhere near the top of that. And so I don't dismiss this, because, you know, there are some issues with cell phones, as we've talked about. It just doesn't feel to me like a pressing concern compared to what else is going on in the system right now.
I agree with that. Shauna mentioned that kids in school don't vote, which is true, and that gives kids in school a lot in common with the vast majority of adults in Lambton, Kent, Middlesex.
Good segue.
Not bad. Yeah, there was a by-election there last night, progressive conservative win, not particularly close. I thought it might be a smidgen closer, but that's not the way that it went. Progressive conservatives got Milton too. That one was closer, but again, they held on to their seats. Here's my question, though. This government has had a whole lot of messes on their hands, mostly Greenbelt-related stuff, and there's still stuff coming out in regards to Greenbelt. But despite that, the vote share doesn't appear to be changing all that much. You know, the Lambton Kent Middlesex vote share was down a little bit, but I think that was just the sign of A, a by-election, and B, people there like Monty McNaught, and they don't really know the guy who won, Steve Pinsonneau, nearly as well. So that's something that happened there. I just look at what happened and think to myself, are Ontarians just generally out on the opposition here? Are they just kind of voting progressive conservative by default? All right, this is the group that's in there now. I don't necessarily love it, but whatever, this is fine. I just wonder if this is a harbinger of bad things for the Liberals and Democrats coming up in 2026, I suppose, is my question. If we can't even really make inroads in by-elections, like, that's when the opposition's supposed to shine in by-elections, right?
I think there's a couple things at play here. One, Liberal Party has a relatively new leader who perhaps has not done maybe as much as she could to introduce herself to the world beyond Mississauga.
Mm-hmm. Milton should have been a spot, though, where
I'm just kind of talking about our part of the world.
Fair enough. Yep.
So there's that. There's also, I think, what's going to be challenging for the Ontario Liberals, rightly or wrongly, is the, let's call it the low poll numbers of our current federal government.
That can't help.
That's certainly not going to help Bonnie Crombie and the Ontario Liberals. As far as the Ontario NDP goes, I mean, I that's a tougher nut to crack, because I think Merritt Stiles is very likable. You know, I don't see how you could look at someone like Merritt Stiles and say, oh God, I'm never voting for that party. Because I think she's quite likable, and I think she's personable, and she presents her policies very well, and I think is generally, you know, a good leader for the party. So there's that. The other thing I think is just there's something about the political climate we're living in right now in terms of information. I think we are, you know, this is just kind of an assumption, but I feel like we're in a place now where people are so dug in, right? And you, people have picked their teams, and they are really reluctant to move away from that. So, you know, even though the last election was not a terribly long time ago, I don't know that the people who voted Conservative PC in the last election have, you know, I guess in their minds seen enough to warrant, you know, leaving that camp. So I think there's just something to be said about people being comfortable on the team that they're on right now. And I think that was reflected. And the low voter turnout too is troubling, to say the least. I mean, Not even a third of the eligible voters in Lambton, Kent, Middlesex. And again, I know it's a by-election. I know it's a majority government at Queen's Park. So the outcome wasn't going to change things in any great way. But when you have less than a third of the people coming out, getting off their couches and going and casting a vote, that's concerning.
But I think that's actually reflective of perhaps some of the turn against the PCs, right? Because you're talking about two PC ridings that have had low voter turnout. And, you know, people are, you know, maybe some people are really stuck in their ways in terms of who they vote for. But if they don't want to vote for the party that they currently vote for, they often will just stay home and choose not to vote. Particularly, you know, in a kind of low stakes situation like a by-election. So, you know, I would say that the low voter turnout may be reflective of some of, you know, a turn against the PCs, but I wouldn't even want to kind of overemphasize that too much, because I think it's just really, you know, that a by-election in April, you know, a couple of years out still from, you know, a regular election just isn't going to reflect the general sentiment of Ontarians. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I think people would have predicted this outcome, you know, pretty handedly. I mean, of course, I wish it had gone a different way, and would say it should have, but you know, these are two ridings that we thought would go to the PCs, and they did. And then the people who didn't want that, they probably just stayed home.
I think a lot of them would have. Yes, I think that they. If I were the Liberals, maybe I just would have wanted to see a little bit more. And I don't think they were ever going to be in a situation where they won. Yeah. But like, did you want to pull in more than 22.5%? That's to me what I would have wanted to see. You're running with, you know, a popular warden, Kathy Burkhardt Jessen. She's well liked there. She won a bunch of elections there. If I were them, I would have wanted to see a little bit more than 22% as well. I don't think that the plan was ever going to be, oh yeah, we have to win, you know, Lambton, Kent, Middlesex. That was not really the way it was going to go. But like, did you want it to be a little bit tighter? That's how I would have felt if I had the Liberals. But
yeah, I think the Liberals would not be happy with this result. I very much agree that they're probably today disappointed in the results.
Like, did you think you could get to the high 20s or the low 30s? Mm-hmm. Like, maybe not necessarily win, but could you have, you know, closed the gap a little bit? And hey, they're 13% up compared to where they were the last time we did an election there. Great. Mm-hmm. But you've got to be the hell of a lot better than that everywhere in the province if you want to have more than, you know, a minivan's worth of caucus.
Yeah, I'm racking my brain. I can't really think of a better candidate for the Liberal Party for that area than Kathy. Yeah. And really, she did everything she could from what I saw to have, you know, a strong campaign that touched all their voters. My wife's best friend moved from Westmount to Mount Bridges during COVID, and she said Kathy was the only candidate who knocked on her door in Mount Bridges, and that won her vote just in itself there. And I wonder maybe if a little bit was dampened when you think of the percentage of farmers, the number of big farms out there, and that we dropped a budget a couple of weeks ago where we massively are raising capital gains taxes. Maybe that might have hurt a little bit of the enthusiasm.
That's different levels, but for a lot of people, that's all going to,
It all blends together, right? Yep. And so I wonder if maybe a little bit of the timing, you know, that hurt the timing a bit. And then also, I know a lot of people who are just not very political, and they see things as being bad everywhere. You open up the news all over the world, the same issues are happening that we see locally. And when you're not being presented with a campaign that has the type of change you're looking for, you're just not that incentivized to do anything differently than you're already doing, right? And I think we're going to stay in that zone until we find ways to make big change, make progress, and to get people working together.
Mm-hmm. It's also a very large riding, especially Lambton, Kent, right? So in terms of those candidates being able to get their message out and get to the doors in a short amount of time, it's not all that realistic.
I'm curious to see, and I'm sure the people who worked on the campaigns are going to dive into this. where was the voter turnout good, bad? Like it was bad everywhere, obviously, but where was it worse? Mm-hmm. Like, was if the voter turnout was good in Chatham and bad sort of in the west side of the riding, or the east side of the riding, rather, like, that would have been advantage for the PCs in this case, just because mm-hmm. you would think that Kathy would be stronger sort of in and around Lucan. So that's something I'd be interested in diving into if I was working in that campaign, just if you're kind of thinking about what's next and where our message is resonating and things along those lines. The other thing that I think might change between now and 2026, well, I think there's no might about it. Well, we're going to have a different prime minister the next time we go to the polls provincially, and Ontario has been known since Confederation, essentially, as liking to, oh, we've got a conservative prime minister, well, we're going to do this. Oh, we've got a liberal prime minister, well, we're going to do this, kind of doing the pendulum swing thing. I'm not saying that will happen, but that's just the way that history has gone in this province. So if Pierre Poilievre is prime minister, maybe they're not going to want Doug Ford to be premier. We'll see. We'll see. A couple other things I wanted to mention before we wrap up. Speaking of Pierre Poilievre, he was in the news this week. He got kicked out of House of Commons. It turned into a fundraising email, which shocked no one. and that's the deal that they did. And here's the thing. Pierre Poilievre, barring some sort of bizarre circumstance that I obviously can barely even envision, Pierre Poilievre is going to be the Prime Minister of Canada at some point in the next 18 months. It's going to happen. This stuff kind of feels a little sideshow-ish to me, though. Like, just like, do your job, be the leader of the opposition, and whenever there's an election, you will win it. Like, I don't know what points you think you're scoring or whatever it is when you're hanging out with the Diaglon guys, which was very clearly a screw-up, and you're going to the House of Commons. And here's the thing. Do I care whether Pierre Poilievre said wacko in the House of Commons? Not particularly, no. But just the reaction to it felt a little forced and a little rehearsed. That's what I took from it.
Yeah, I feel largely the same way. When he called the Prime Minister wacko, I mean, yeah, I mean, was it unparliamentary? Sure. Is it a big deal? God, no. I mean, let's unclutch our pearls here a little bit.
Justin Trudeau called somebody a piece of shit in the House of Commons one time.
Exactly.
And then he got kicked out for it.
But what bothers me about it is the second part. I mean, this was clear, like, it's theater. And maybe it's because I'm getting older, but I'm just so goddamn tired of the theater. Yeah. I really am. Like, we, you know, and this goes back to what we were saying before. Like, things are really challenging right now. We have an opioid crisis. We have a housing crisis. We have all of these issues that, for God's sakes, can we get some serious politicians to deal with this shit? And I'm just so goddamn tired of the theater, of the performances that are meant to solicit donations. Like, I'm just really fed up with it. Like, for God's, like, the times we're living in right now are crying out, screaming out for serious people to deal with them. And time and time again, these people are showing us that they are not serious people. They're performers, they're actors. And as a citizen, I'm just, like I said, tired of it. So please stop this nonsense and get to work, for God's sakes. Like, and that goes for all of them. Like in this case, we're talking about Poilievre, but he's not the only one that's done this. This kind of shit happens all the time. This performance and this lack of serious approach to real issues that are causing suffering. And I'm tired of it. Like, for God's sakes, people, get it together and start acting like start being the adult in the room.
I'll start.
I don't think that's
leaders,
too much to ask.
Yeah, mm-hmm. Absolutely. I mean, it's, oh, there's so much to say. So, you know, I actually don't think that it's pearl clutching. I get where you're coming from on that. But it is the decorum matters, because one, it detracts from getting the job done. It detracts from actually answering the questions that are being asked. And I don't think that Poilievre was the only one who was guilty of that. I think Trudeau was evading the answers mm-hmm. and like jabbing back and forth, which is what happens in the House of Commons, but it should happen a whole lot less. And I think the speaker holding the line on when you cross that line into calling somebody a wacko was a good call. Mm-hmm. And it leads to not only, you know, an inability to move, like, you know, the progress on, you know, actually talking about the issues and making decisions, it turns people off of politics. It turns people off of voting, but it also makes people not want to run, you know, and that means women, that means racialized folks, that means people with disabilities who are subject to those kinds of experiences on a regular, and who wants to enter into a place where that's allowed and that's actually the norm. And that's really where we're at with the House of Commons and the way the behavior. And I'll disagree with you, Craig, because I absolutely understand based on the polls why you think it's an inevitability yeah. that he'll win. But you know that politics, anything can happen, and a lot can happen between now and the next election. And when Polyev is acting this way, when he's behaving this way, he's pushing lines to see how far he can go and what we're willing to accept and what people are willing to accept. And, you know, I think that the people who are, you know, sort of in his corner and in his ear would be wise and are probably saying to him, you need to tone it down. Yeah, we might have just raised, you know, a million or more, a couple million. I don't know how much they yeah. raised out of it, but a lot. But, you know, that doesn't do us any good if you don't get elected.
Don't like, and here, so Daryl Bricker, the pollster, tweeted this out, I forget when, but it was after a poll. And he said, let's be very clear about something. Canadians don't like Pierre Poilievre and want him to be prime minister. Mm-hmm. Canadians are just done with the current yeah. government, and he's what's around. So I just think, I'm not saying it's like over. Like I said, weird stuff can happen. I just don't know if Canadians are going to become any less done with the current governing point in the next 18 months. Now, hey, maybe there is some sort of huge change and all of a sudden everyone says, hey, you know what? I'm going to try the NDP, see what happens. I think though that because of the moves they've made during this parliament, the New Democrats, or at least Jagmeet Singh, is kind of attached to the current government. And I just think that people are saying, if people are saying, I want something different, I don't care what it is, this is going to be the only spot where they wind up going. I think there's going to be a huge number of Bloc Québécois MPs elected mm-hmm. the next time we do this federally. Because I think a lot of people in Quebec are going to say, you know what, screw these parties, forget it. I'm just going to vote for these guys because whatever, why not? And so I think there's going to be a lot of that. And I'm not saying, you know, it's over forever. I just think that it would take a really large event to derail Pierre Poilievre becomes prime minister at this point.
Yeah. Craig might remember this reference. So what Pierre is doing right now is he's basically doing the Bill Gramatica. He's already made the field goal and now he's blowing his ACL in the celebration. And really all it's doing is it's turning the House of Commons, you know, sacred grounds into, it's like Rideau Canal Shore, like they're fist pumping and going out to the club afterwards. And it's just, it's a bit of a dumpster fire. And like your average person isn't into that sort of grandstanding stuff where it's finger pointing and all that name calling, because they just want to see solutions. They want to feel that their tax dollars are well invested. And people don't really expect that the boardroom of a major corporation is a bunch of people calling each other names and kicking each other out and high-fiving on the way. They expect their government to run like a professional organization. So it's unfortunate to watch. And really, it all gets amplified on social media because it's the us versus them mentality of the, can you believe he did this? Oh my gosh. And nothing's really going to change, unfortunately. And I think going into the next election, the best thing Justin Trudeau could do, as somebody who's voted for all three major parties at least once, step down and do a Brian Mulroney, let somebody else take over and see if that changes the appetite, right?
Yeah, well, I think that and just to go back to what you were saying, Sean, about decorum mattering, and I agree, it does matter. What I would say is you know, the act is wearing thin in Parliament, right? Like in question period. And I think about, you know, one of the first things I thought of over the whole Poilievre wacko thing was, I think it was it maybe within the last year, I think it was, there was an incident, and I remember I was watching it. I was watching it on CPAC. Yes, sometimes I watch CPAC.
As we all do.
And I don't know that my eyes have ever rolled back in my head faster than at this moment. There was a moment where Michelle Garner-Rempel was talking, and she used the word fart. And Elizabeth May stood up in Parliament and basically demanded that word be withdrawn because it was unparliamentary language. And I thought, in that moment, I thought, you've got to be kidding me. Mm-hmm. Everything that's going on in this country right now, and you are going to take up time in Parliament to register what I guess was your disgust over the use of the word fart. And so, mm-hmm. you know, it comes back to that. It's like, yes, decorum matters, but let's not be silly about it. And I think, again, to borrow a phrase that I hear from Craig a lot, your mileage may vary on this. The thing that bothered me most about the Polyev Wacko thing was that it was how calculated it was.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it just seemed like an act.
It was an act, and it was all designed, you know. And this is one of the reasons why there's a big part of me that thinks that Question Period should not be televised.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it got worse.
Because it's performance. In
the social media era, it's worse because that 1 minute chunk now. Because that 1 minute chunk never, ever used to make the news.
Yeah.
Because who's going to put a 1 minute chunk of Question Period into a news story, unless something really crazy happens. But now, that 1 minute chunk, you can put that on your Facebook page. You can put that on Twitter or X or whatever and do whatever you want with it.
Yeah.
And you've just put that 1 minute chunk there of whatever sort of theater you've come up with. So I think the social media era has made Question Period worse, no question.
Mm-hmm. Social media era has made a lot of things worse.
Yes, it has. Yeah.
But amped up the theater of it for sure.
Yeah. Absolutely. I want to talk about one more thing before we wrap up. And that would be the calls to boycott Loblaw stores here in the month of May. And Galen Weston was at a shareholders meeting this week, and he was really upset. I'm going to be honest with you, Galen, and this just like, if you're mad about something, don't tell anyone, because if you're upset about something, that's going to make other people happy. Yeah. So like, you should say that you love the idea of boycotting Loblaws. Like, you should say it's great. But he was upset about it and explaining why. Well, I don't think Canadians are going to fall for this misinformation. Meanwhile, like, most of us know how to read financial statements. This is the only thing I want to say about it. There are awesome people who work at Loblaw's own stores in this city. They're great. They're just doing their jobs. I don't think we need to be, you know, doing anything that targets them or makes their day any worse. I saw some people say, oh, you should go to Loblaw stores and fill your cart and then walk out. Like, all that's going to do is make the day worse for the staff. Don't do that.
Don't do that.
However, you can spend your money wherever it is you're so inclined, and you can make that decision however you would like. And I don't know if this is going to make a difference, but the fact that Galen Weston is talking about it at shareholder meetings tells you that at the very least it's on the radar.
Oh, it's made a difference.
Yes.
That's exactly what a boycott should be doing, right? Like, you know, will it hit them in their bottom line? Hopefully a little bit. Will it make a huge difference? Of course not. They're a multi-billion dollar, you know, organization.
But the fact that they're thinking about it.
Yeah, that it's on the radar, that it's in the media, and not just like, you know, I mean, I've been a part of a lot of boycotts over my, you know, many, many years, and many of them are kind of more fringe and on the edge and only happen within like certain circles and communities. But I think that this one has some pretty mainstream legs where, you know, probably the majority of people are not going to boycott, but people are having these conversations amongst their friends and families, and there's probably a smattering of people within, you know, everyone's circle that are going to participate or do their best to participate. And again, it's not about necessarily, you know, being like absolutely like dogmatic in it and, you know, oh, I went to Shoppers, it's over, whatever. But it's really a boycott is one of its, you know, aims is to raise the issue in the public perception. Mm-hmm. Huge success. Huge success on that.
And here's something to think about. So a ad hoc community organized boycott has had as much or more impact in the Loblaws boardroom as anything the provincial and federal government has done.
Yeah.
And we just talked about a 30% voter turnout, right?
Yep.
Maybe it's just putting faith back into the people that can make a difference, right? So.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely.
I don't know. The fact that they're talking about it, that tells you what you need to know. If the point was sending a message, the message has been sent and the message has been received.
Mm-hmm.
I know that the original boycotters, cut all prices by 15%. That was not going to happen.
Mm-hmm.
However, like, hey, let's just like think about this. You made, what was it, $13 billion in Q1.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe there is some profiteering going on here. Like, you know, like mm-hmm. just like just recognize to the public that, okay, well, maybe we could alter this or alter that. And here's the thing. I think that if they said we're going to not really alter prices all that much, but we're going to have a few more employees at the store and we're going to pay our employees a little bit more, maybe people aren't so mad about this stuff. I get that for the most people, it's just going to be about the bottom line. But I think that what raises the ire about this company, and again, there are great people that work for the company, but what raises
great
the
franchisees,
ire. Yeah, absolutely. Phenomenal franchisees that do incredible stuff in the community.
Yeah.
Would never challenge that for a second. But what raises the ire is when you see, okay, this is what they pulled in this quarter. And you think to yourself, okay, you're pulling in X amount dollars, huge amounts of money, and I've seen my grocery bills go up. I'm getting less for more money. how do I not think there's going to be profiteering going on here? You know what I mean? How do I not think this is going to be a price-fixing situation again? And I know that people, and I've had this debate online with people, speak like, oh, you think all the Canadian grocers are getting together and price-fixing? That's conspiratorial. No, it's not. They've done it before. Oh, I think these people that did this thing one time might be doing it again. That's not crazy. That's a thing they might have done, right? Yeah. Like, it's something that happened.
Yeah. So we've been unintentionally boycotting Loblaws for about the last 2 years. I have a no-frills 400 meters from my house, and we used to be there every week without fail. My kids are 11, 9, and 7, massive just like myself. And so we spent about $18,000 at Costco last year on groceries. Wow. Because of that 2% rebate check. It's pretty easy to figure that out. We do still have to go to no-frills for things that Costco does not carry, but we went from enough no-frills to get about $400 a year back there to now we just go to Costco instead, because you really get more for a little bit less money, and the math works out. So it's really, for an average family like myself, we haven't had a choice for quite some time, and it'll have to continue for as long as No Frills becomes not really an affordable place to shop anymore.
Right. And like that's what this boycott can do, right? It can also start people on new patterns. Yep. Where they go different places and they go, oh, this is actually feasible. I could shop at the market and it's not that much more expensive. Plus there's this benefit, or, you know, go to a different store or their local store or whatever it may be. The other thing I think it does that's really important, especially in a time of so much, disillusion with government and everything, it just reminds people that we actually have power. And in a capitalist society, our power is very much in what we choose.
Absolutely.
To spend our money on, right?
Couldn't
and you can
more.
Feel really like, that can feel just not true for so many mm-hmm. people at an individual level. But when you see something like this and people are reminded, no, it matters where I shop, yeah. It matters where I put my money, then it kind of mobilizes people that they can make change, and they can collectively. We are very powerful, right? We are much more powerful than them. Mm-hmm. They only survive because we allow them to survive, and all the handouts and all that sort of stuff.
Right.
So don't forget that piece, tax breaks, yeah.
So like, and that's the thing is, when people want to say, you know, defenses of capitalism, and obviously the term I think sometimes gets misconstrued. Either way, the fact that you get to vote with your wallet, that's the main good thing, is you get to vote with your wallet and decide where your money gets to go. And people get to decide that however they're so inclined, clearly. So we'll
unless
see.
You live in a small town that has one
and, right. And that's, yeah. There's going to be some of that too. And like, people have their reasons, and I'm not going to sit here and say, oh, everyone who shops at Loblaw this month is bad. I don't know. You shop wherever you want. Mm-hmm. Do whatever you want. Like, you do what you want. But this is absolutely a news story that needs to be discussed. A lot of people are talking about it, including Galen Weston, including Per Bank, who looks like they, like, clone Galen Weston. He looks like, you know, the Simpsons episode when Mr. Burns put on a mask and called himself Mr. Snrub. He looks like that, version of Galen Weston. Or put on a mustache, rather. Either way, like, these guys are talking about it. So, yeah, like, this has made a difference. And it, like, and this is, we talked about the bad things about social media. This is kind of, like, really taken off from a Reddit subgroup.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
mm-hmm. I think it's called, like, Loblaw is out of control, I think is the name of the group. And there's, 70,000 people who are in it. And this is kind of where it, like, really, really launched. So yeah. We'll see what difference it makes, if it makes a difference. But I think even the fact that the executives of these companies were, you know, quarter one, I think the profit was $450 million. The revenue was $13 billion. The fact that these companies are having to talk about this at their shareholder meetings, That in and of itself is a win right there. The fact that there are headlines, Galen Weston addresses, you know, Loblaw's executives about boycott. Yep. That in and of itself is a win for the people that organize this thing.
Yeah, and like, I have a Shoppers Drug Mart 700 meters from my house, and I just moved all my prescriptions from there to a place probably 3 kilometers away that's locally owned one-off, because if you go into Shoppers these days, you're now down to maybe one checkout, and the rest is all automated checkouts. And like, where are our kids supposed to get entry-level jobs if we keep automating these entry-level work to where they learn work skills to move up the ladder? And it's not like our service got any better or the prices got any lower. I saw the article for CBC that came out today that formula's up 30% in 2 years. And now places like Shoppers and Loblaws put it behind lock and key because moms have had to choose between stealing it or not feeding their children, right? And so you're really, it comes down to, like Loblaws said, we've made $9 billion or whatever, and it's at the expense of us as the consumers.
Yeah. Well, I'll tell you a quick formula story, then we got to wrap up because we've been at this for a little while here. When my daughter was born, so just after she was born, I was at, it was the Metro in East London, and I go there to pick up some formula, and they had lost the formula key. So I had to stand there for, I think it was 15 minutes where they looked for the formula key. And I sort of said like to the person, the staff person, look, I know this is not your idea to have this locked up, but why is the formula the thing that's locked up? And they're like, well, they're concerned about theft because it's expensive. I'm like, there are stakes that cost twice what this formula does 30 meters from here.
Yeah.
They're not locked up. Mm-hmm. It's because formula is what people take when they are desperate because, hey, if I'm willing to break bad here, formula is what I'm willing to do it for. That's why it's locked up. It's gross. It's ick.
It's
gross. And again, I'm not saying that every retailer should just be fine with getting stolen from, but like, okay, it's the fact that like this is the one thing that you want to lock, like that. You have stuff that's more expensive than that here in the store, but this is the thing you want to, it's kind of skin crawly stuff. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Anyway, shop wherever you want. This is definitely a thing that, that a lot of people are talking about. That's all the time we have here on the Friday Roundtable. You know where you should shop? It's the Covent Garden Market.
Definitely.
The Craig Needles podcast is powered by the Covent Garden Market and our friends over at Downtown London. Many great restaurants in Downtown London. Get your food there. Of course, you can find us at classicrock981.com, londonnewstoday.ca. Thank you very much to Scott and to Shauna and to Jeremy for doing the show with us this week. Have a great weekend whenever you listen to this, and we'll talk to you on Tuesday on the Craig Needles podcast.
The Craig Needles Podcast is a presentation of the Blackburn Media Podcast Network.